presence, with his insight and his knowledge born of 27 years of sobriety. I would like to introduce you all, without further ado, to the man whose nickname is Silly Billy. Come on up, Billy.
That's a way to start. Don't even get the microphone keyed right. Hi, everybody. Now, hang on just a second. Struck me that staying alive is so ideal, such an ideal thing, title to use in a situation like this, sharing with people who do want to stay alive, people who do care very much. Hello, everybody. My name is Billy. I am a nicotine addict, among other things. Oh, it's nice to be here. Very, very nice. Before I get deeply into my history and my story, I was at a nice picnic today. As a matter of fact, I actually left there a little early. They're cooking these wild things over an open wood fire. They smelled divine. They tasted divine. But I knew this was where I wanted to be tonight. Very, very important to me. My recovery and those who are also in recovery. That's the best thing going for me. Smoking. My history. Oh, my. In no particular order. I was born. I was born in the late 1940s. Had an average childhood. Until at the little before the age of six, I was stricken with what was then called polio. It was pretty severe. I wound up going in the hospital in early October and being discharged the day before Christmas. So it was just under 3 months I was in there. They carried me in, pretty much unable to move, and I pretty well walked out on my own. So, right then and there is when I should have been down on my knees saying, "Oh my God, thank you God, thank you God, thank you God." I was grateful. The story about this bears some fruit as to what I'm going to talk about later on in my life. Yeah, share it all. The following year after polio, I started first grade all over again because I didn't go back to school the rest of the year. Actually, after a while, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I was walking up a street one day when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, going to the neighborhood barbershop. And some cool guy, maybe like 12 or 14, flicked a cigarette onto the sidewalk that he was done with. And I thought that would be really cool if I picked it up and just carried it with me up the street to the barbershop so I could look like I was smoking. I was so scared, but I did it. I wanted to be cool, even at about the age of 6 or 7. We have no way of knowing what our future will bring. But there are certain things that kind of set the tone, no matter how innocent or how casual they may be. Oh, let's fast forward through the early years. Thanks to polio, a couple of things happened. One may not have been thanks to polio. I grew rather tall. I was always pretty much the tallest kid in my class. But thanks to the polio, I pretty much couldn't do a darn thing. I mean, I could attempt to play sports, I could attempt to fight, I could attempt to do whatever, but it never turned out so well. So when you're the biggest one around and you can't fight, it makes you an easy target, a very easy target. So now we'll chalk that one up on the shelf to the self-worth issues and how they come into place as life goes along. Other than that, childhood was good. Got into high school, it was good as well. Still, once again, the tallest one in class and eventually the tallest in the school. They wanted me to play basketball. I couldn't do that, but that was okay. By then, I was smoking. Oh, I got to go back here. I messed up. Seventh grade, I bought a pack of cigarettes, but I wasn't quite sure what to do with them. I eventually threw them away. They got pretty bad. Eighth grade, I did it again, but this time I didn't throw them away because the people that I looked up to, so to speak, were smoking. They were cool. And a brother 6 years older than I, he smoked. He was cool. Little did I know. I was about 14 years old when it started. Very gradual. Cigarette here, cigarette there. And, of course, when hanging around with my friends, because by then, everybody had to smoke. Of course, I couldn't let my parents know about it because that would have been a big no-no. By the time I graduated high school, I was smoking about a pack a day. Oh, and my parents did know it. Well along the way, we figured that one out pretty quick. And, oops, I forgot another part. Right between grammar school and high school, my father, who was a very, very heavy smoker all his life, it seemed like. I think he might have been born with a cigarette in his mouth. I'm not sure. Right after eighth grade in the summer, my dad went in the hospital for some pretty dramatic surgery at that time. It was in the earlier 60s, and he had cancer. The cancer was not totally internal in his throat, but it was more like exterior on the neck. And they wound up just pretty much taking out one side of everything except the carotid artery, and they said he was free and clear of cancer. He never stopped smoking. He smoked when he was in the hospital. You could do that then. He smoked before the surgery. He smoked after the surgery. And he kept going about 2 to 3 packs a day, Camels. And I don't even know what kind of cigarettes are what nowadays. I know they have Camel filters, but these weren't filtered and these weren't weak. These were the big old ones. If you were a kid and you smoked a Camel, you were dizzy. He was cured of cancer, they said. He had the surgery, he had radiation treatments. 9 to 10 years later, after a lot more smoking, he had a sore throat. Went to a doctor who was an old family friend. The guy wasn't much of a doctor, but he was an old family friend. He says to my father, you got a little strep or something in there. He prescribed an antibiotic. And it kept happening over and over and over again. So finally, my father went to a specialist. They took one look. And I don't know what the first doctor was seeing or not seeing, but the second doctor quite clearly saw a pretty good-sized tumor right on his voice box. And it was metastasized or spread or whatever the right word is, spread enough where removing the voice box wasn't going to do it. Was not going to do it, so they just started treating him. In the around mid-1973, with chemotherapy, which was in its infancy, they couldn't give him any more radiation, and he still kept smoking. In the hospital, out of the hospital, near the hospital, he just kept smoking. By late 1974, numerous surgical procedures were done to reduce the tumor, and it kept growing back bigger and bigger. And I guess it was early November he was admitted to the hospital. By then his weight was about half of what it had once been, and he was there in the hospital, and once he got himself situated and sitting up a little bit, he fired up a cigarette. About 5 days later, he died. This is a man who, in his prime, stood 6'2", weighed around 225 pounds. Most of it was muscle. He could go up a 50-foot ladder one-handed while carrying two bundles of roofing shingles. He had a roofing business. So the smoking wasn't bad enough. He had that giant tar bucket always towing around that would just spew out all that nice, lovely gas to help things along. The reason I bring up all this history about my dad is because, many reasons. For one, he was a really great guy, a really nice guy, a lot of fun, excellent sense of humor. He didn't let anybody give any grief to his wife or his kids, and for that I'm grateful. Excuse me. He died November 3rd or 2nd of 1974. I stopped smoking in March of 1984. What in God's name was I thinking of? How could I see my father go through this, all this stuff, and I just kept smoking like nothing was wrong? So did my brother. My mom, for some reason, never smoked. She used to try it once in a while. She thought it would help with weight control. She'd smoke one cigarette and it would help her with weight control. She'd be sick for 2 days. Oh, my, my, my. A lot of fun remembering that kind of stuff. A lot of fun. Fast forward again to me in my married life. I was married in late 1969. In early 1984, my wife was going into the hospital for a planned surgery, and by then smoking was not allowed in the hospital, and she was a smoker. I was a smoker. My kids were not yet smokers. The day or two before going in the hospital, she said, "Hey, let's not buy any cigarettes, and when we run out of cigarettes Sunday night, that's it. Let's both quit. I can't smoke in the hospital anyway, and why don't you quit? You'll be home with the kids for a week. You send them to school, you'll be on your own. You won't be around anybody smoking." I could not come up with one darn reason to keep smoking. It was like, how dare she? How dare she do that? Come up with this innocent sequence, this innocent sounding sequence that was going to dramatically alter my life. How could she do this? She had a hell of a nerve. Well, she went in the hospital on Sunday and finished her cigarettes in the whatever room it was, the room where you could go and smoke. And I finished mine on Sunday evening as well and went to bed and got up Monday, and she was gone to surgery bright and early. And I scouted through just about every ashtray in Massachusetts to get a little puff or two off of a nub. But come around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there were no little nubs to smoke. And excuse me a second. There was nothing left to puff on, so that was it for me. And I said to myself, "Self, what do you do now?" And by then, both kids are home from school, which was not a big deal. They're good kids. And I kind of powered my way through the rest of the day, being the mommy and the daddy, and got the word from the doctor that everything was okay and the surgery went well, and kind of made it through the day. I've never been a nail biter, so I didn't do that. And surprisingly, I didn't gorge myself on food either, at least not on that day. But I did get through it. I did get through it, and couldn't quite figure out how I did get through it, because the cravings, and we know about cravings, don't we? Yeah, I think we do. The cravings were pretty significant. And at that time, I had no knowledge of whether cravings were physical, emotional, or both. No concept of it. None whatsoever. I've shared this at the midnight meeting quite a few times, but there's a lot of people here I have not seen before. And by the way, it's great to see so many here tonight. God bless you all. Makes me feel really good. On day number 2, got up in the morning, got the kids off to school, sat down, had my second cup of coffee. Somehow, I don't know how this happened. If you have a God in your life, as I do, I say I chalk it up to God's trying to give me a hand. I realized right away that I didn't feel any worse than I did the day before. The craving was there. Yeah, I'd like a smoke. But it was like, come on, man. You got through yesterday. You can do this. And I did do it. How did I do it? I have no idea. I have a funny feeling that for once, instead of talking somebody else into something, I talked myself into it, and I believed it. And it got me through day number 2, and number 3, and number 4, and number 5. My wife came home from the hospital on Saturday, day number 6. She was not smoking. I was not smoking. The following Monday, day 8, I went back to work. Had a tiny little office for our gathering point, myself and my coworkers. And they'd come in and out of there all day long, as I would. And everybody else except me was a smoker. I don't know if that helped me or hurt me. I really don't know. But I got through it, and it was like the cravings had really diminished in that first week. And going to work, it was like smelling it in a different way. And I was it wasn't bad smelling. After not smoking for a week, no, it was damn good smelling, as a matter of fact. But I didn't want one. I can't figure this out for the life of me. I really can't. If people tell you that God does things for you that you cannot do for yourself, believe it. Believe it indeed. Or whatever your higher power may be. Some people think a recovery group such as this is a tremendous higher power. And that can very well be. They will help you set your goal and keep to it. I wish I had found this group way back then, but there wasn't even such a thing as PCs. Oh yeah, you guys don't do it, but I could do it if I can figure out how. Oh God, how do I do that? This doesn't come with instructions, but that's okay. None of us are perfect. That's fine. As of today, I have been quick for 27 years, 4 months, 4 days, 6 hours, 39 minutes and 28 seconds, 9,987 days. In just about 2 weeks, or a week from Friday, will be day number 10,000. I pray to God that I can make it. I'm going to give it a shot, one day at a time. For those who are new to this, new to trying to quit, or for the first time really serious about it, or anywhere in between, wherever you're at, this 9,900 days, this didn't happen all at once. No. It says down the bottom, my quit date is March 5th, 1984 at 3 p.m. Could I have planned something like this? No. No, 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 no. No way. No how. Couldn't do it in a zillion years. I planned a million times to quit smoking. I would quit for 4 hours. I would quit for 3 hours. I would quit for 3 minutes. I would quit for whatever. I would go to work where there was no cigarette machines, and I would go with only a half a pack, and I'd be bumming before the day was over. Couldn't plan something like this. It fell into place by accident, and it kept going with a power that's beyond me, with the help of a power that's beyond me. Not necessarily beyond my comprehension, though it probably is. I believe in God. I trust in God. I don't quite know what God looks like. I guess nobody does. Unless you believe the movie that God looks like George Burns. That could very well be. I don't know. 9,987 days happened. 9,987 days at a time. One day at a time. Not painless days, not powerless days, not crazy days, just single days, one at a time. I better not proudly say that I haven't saved $49,000. I'm sure I would have come up with the money to buy those cigarettes if I had to. Almost 300,000 cigarettes. 3 cartons shy of 300,000 cigarettes. That number just... I can't deal with that number. I have no idea what it means. No idea. 300,000 cigarettes. What is that? That is something I would have put in my body over the last 27 years by smoking around a pack and a half a day, give or take a little. That's what I plugged into this formula thing. 30 cigarettes per day. Oh, man. Have I saved 11 years, 4 months, 3 weeks of my life? Sure. I'm sure I have. But you know what? I think I've saved 27 years, 4 months, 4 days, 6 hours, 39 minutes, and 28 seconds of my life. That's what I think I've saved. Because I was hurting. I was really, really hurting. I was not yet 40 years old. I was severely overweight. I was smoking way too much for me. I couldn't go up a flight of stairs without being severely out of breath, hacking like crazy. My first day back to work, I flew up a flight of stairs. What's that about? Excuse me again. I need to take a drink here. Excuse me, please. Okay, it's going to sound like I'm going to branch out into another topic, but it actually is going to wind up putting this whole story together. In January of 1985, a family member was suggested to a family member by a professional that they investigate Overeaters Anonymous. And they didn't know what to do about it, so me being me, I said, oh, I'll go check it out for you. And I did. I went to a big book meeting. Didn't take very long till I found out they were talking about me, because I had quit smoking. Excuse me, I got to reposition this microphone. There we go. I had quit smoking, but I hadn't quit binging on food. I never did binge on the alcohol. I couldn't do that. I had two hangovers in my life, the first one and the last one. That was the end for me. I kept going to OA. The person in the family it was suggested to checked it out a few times and never really pursued it. But they got skinny anyway. Go figure. I went into OA and Compulsive Silly Billy, you know, the guy that smoked for so many years, Compulsive Silly Billy, within about 8-9 months, lost about 105, 110 pounds just by getting rid of all the baloney in his life. And that's not fried baloney. That's BS baloney. This does relate to Voice of Nicotine Recovery. It relates directly. Because without going into all the details, I worked my steps in that program diligently. I acquired a sponsor. I acquired a second sponsor. Hear this now. I started sponsoring people once I had good abstinence under my belt. And for your information, my definition of abstinence in OA was 3 common sense meals a day with life in between. Not one continuous meal. People, due to health conditions or other reasons, medication, have to alter their meals, and that's totally understandable, and that's fine. Common sense is the key. Okay. I worked my steps slowly but surely, stayed active in OA many, many, many years. Even after November of 1989, November 9th, 1989, 3:30 in the morning, my phone rang. My son was bunking in 2 blocks away. He was 18 and had moved out on his own. He was in full cardiac arrest. By the time I got to him, he had just crossed over. He was dead. The medics showed up. The EMTs, the paramedics, they started working on him. It was way too late. People told me in program that there would be a test coming at some point, and you never knew what it would be, whether it would be a flat tire, a cut shaving. You don't know the magnitude of things. You never know, but things are going to come that are going to put you to the test. that was the one that did, as it would do to anyone. You take the calendar, you turn it upside down. And that's what it felt like to me. A long time after that was a blur. Real, real blur. Cigarettes looked real good then. They looked really, really, really good. But I didn't light up. Thank you, God, I did not light up. And the food stayed in good shape, too, for a while. Then it got sloppy and sloppier and sloppier. Okay, here we go. Let's go fast forward now to 2011. A lot of stuff happened in between, but yeah, you were right, Paula. Once you get talking, it flies by. I now am in a wheelchair due to late life effects of that childhood polio. I had a very good life. I did many things. You did the homeowner things. You build a deck. You do this. You add a room on and on and on. You remodel. You do this. You do that. I did it all. I did it pretty well. I had a good time. I had some good jobs. Things were really, really great, and I very much appreciate it. In the very late 90s, my lower extremities were giving me problems, some stiffness. By late 2001 or 2002, I don't even know anymore. Late 02, I think it was, I was diagnosed with something called post-polio syndrome. And it's the late life effects of childhood polio. About a year and a half later after the diagnosis, a specialist in that field said, I want you in a chair so you can save what you have. I didn't understand it, but we started working on it. And yeah, insurance company sure dragged our hiney. By the time I got the chair, it was April of 2005, and by then I couldn't walk. It wasn't pretty. I was using a four-wheel walker, and it was pretty bad. I got my first chair in April 2005, and I just cycled into my second one earlier this year. You know what? It's okay. It's okay, and when I put this story together here in a minute, you'll know why it's okay. Well, you already know one reason. I'm not smoking. If I were smoking, I wouldn't have even had any need for the chair. I wouldn't have been here. As of right now, I am coming up on 8 years older than my father when he passed. And I feel pretty darn good. I feel pretty darn good. Yeah, I had to retire. So what? Yeah, I can't go dancing. So what? I never could dance good anyway. But here I am, and it's okay. I have a wheelchair. It's a power chair. I can get around. I have a vehicle with a lift. I can go out and go places. It's good. Earlier this year, I think it was around February, give or take. Paula will remember that fateful night. I happened to cross this room by accident. I had been trying to find an OA meeting close to where I live so I could get there. And the closest one I found was 40 to 50 miles away and not entirely handicap friendly. Didn't know what I was going to do. Was on Pal Talk scouting around, and I see this Voices of Nicotine Recovery. So I came into the room, and it was around 1:15 in the morning, or no, excuse me, it was a little before 1 a.m. And I'm listening to people share. And I'm saying right off the bat to myself, this is 12-step. This is what I need. This is 12-step. It doesn't make any difference, the substance. What makes the difference is the steps. People wanting recovery. So I kept coming in and I kept coming back. Born Free, what the heck are you doing? I kept coming in, I kept coming back. And I saw immediately how much this applied to me. Yeah, I could say I had successfully quit smoking, but I had very unsuccessfully quit compulsive behavior. I was still compulsive. Next thing I knew, sometimes cigarettes were smelling good after 27 years. Sometimes cigarettes are smelling real good. What am I going to do about it? I have something to do about it. I have a meeting to go to. I have Voices of Nicotine Recovery. I can come here and share with you that it smells good, but I don't want to pick up that crap today because I don't need it in my body. I don't want it in my body. One day at a time, I am going to kick however hard it takes to get this stuff out of my body, away from me and not in my body. I originally thought that I was using nicotine recovery program to control my food, which it's actually helping with, by the way. I've lost about 20 pounds with no exercise in a wheelchair. But that's not it. It's about working these steps. It's about staying sober. It's about keeping my life on track one day at a time. It's about keeping my head clear so that I can maintain a friendly, loving relationship with my wife and my daughter and my grandkids. Now, if the cat stops waking me up at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll have a friendly, loving relationship with her, too. I actually do. Program is wonderful. Voices of Nicotine Recovery is a wonder in itself. People helping people because they want to help others and they want to be helped by others. There's no magic here. It's no magic. It's like when you say that third step prayer. Everybody raise your hand. Join together. One person alone can't do a whole lot, but a bunch of us together, we can get out there and we can kick that habit, and we can help other people kick that habit one day at a time. Yeah, I have 27 years and 4 months. You know what I have? I right now have today, and today is one of the nicest days I've had in a long time. This is the first time I have spoken in a 12-step meeting in probably close to 20 years. Feels pretty darn good. I don't know what I said. I certainly hope it helped. It feels good to me. I had something that I let go and I wanted to bring back, and for the life of me, I don't remember what it was. But I always do that. I always do that. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. I'll just kind of finish up with this. How do I say it? I heard it in another program, but I've heard it in many programs used, and I'm sure people use it here. Thank you for loving me. Thank you for helping me. Thank you for caring for me. And thank you for accepting me as I am, unconditionally, and accepting me as I am until I become what I want to be, one day at a time. I think I'm pretty well done for now. Copies of this will be available at Post Office Box for $10.95. No, thank you all very, very, very much. You're my life. God bless you all. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Billy. And I knew you could do it. I had a feeling you might be able to fill up the time.